are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, July 26th on a hybrid Sam Steeder, Michael Brooks Thursday, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Sam's interview with Randy Weingarten. She's the head of the teachers union. They're talking about education in the age of austerity and Trump, union activism and organizing from the grassroots, and the future strategy for the American Federation of Teachers. That was interview that Sam recorded a bit over a week ago. And then we will take you into the fun half. Separated parents were totally unaware that they had waived their rights to be reunited with their kidnapped children. Trump and the EU announced a deal.
What? Gotta read the fine print.
Gotta read the fine print. Trump and the EU announced a deal to avert the escalation of trade tensions. Very similar to the North Korea deal. There's nothing in it. It's aspirational. Totally aspirational. Donald Trump's poll numbers are sinking and sagging and getting to a sad and sunken place in key Midwestern states, Michigan and Wisconsin.
I'm going to pretend you meant to say poll numbers because that works really well.
I did say poll numbers. You didn't hear me.
That's not what you meant.
I know. I got it. State Department defends allowing the publication of blueprint for 3D print guns. Nice.
Very
good. Looking forward to that. Dropping a little Peter Thiel. A Coke plan to raise prices amidst Trump's proposed trade war. And more than 200 killed in southern Syria as the Islamic State launches a devastating assault. Yes, that multi-pronged imperial war is still happening. And Trump has cut aid to the UN Relief Agency so it can lay off staff in Gaza and the West Bank. And in a positive piece of foreign news, 29 members of Congress, including Senator Bernie Sanders, Keith Ellison, Maxine Waters, Ro Khanna, Barbara Lee, and Mark Pocan, have written a letter to Brazil's ambassador protesting the imprisonment of Lula da Silva, his violation of his human rights in the lead-up to the election, the anti-democratic investigation moves to block Lula from running, as well as the fact that the assassination of Marielle Franco has still not been addressed, as Brazil's austerity lawfare government powers ahead and a fascist candidate runs second in the polls to the imprisoned Lula. All that and more on today's Majority Report. But let's start with a piece of, just news. And you can process in yourselves whether you think that this is funny, whether you think this is awesome, whether you think that this is actually really uncivil.
A sign of decline.
A sign of decline. It's up to you how you interpret the fact that Betsy DeVos's $30 million yacht was vandalized at a Huron dock.
No.
Betsy DeVos, a boat, Huron, Ohio, a boat owned by the family of U.S. Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, was vandalized over the weekend, moored at the Huron dock, according to the Huron Police Department. The SeaQuest was moored at the Huron boat base at 330 Main Street, according to a police report. And apparently what somebody did was they just undocked it. They just cut it from the dock, and it had a little bump and a little boo-boo. And I don't know if there was actually literally, of course, in the comedic scenario, Betsy DeVos is like, you know, there's a new charter school plan where we were thinking to ourselves, why can't children in America stitch Nike shoes for 5 pennies an hour? And so it was a really interesting market-based initiative to help poor kids. Let's go talk about it on the Sequest. Oh! And the guy, what the darn?
The guy who did it is like, oh, I didn't set it adrift, Betsy. I gave it a voucher.
Yeah, I didn't set it adrift. I gave it an opportunity to participate its own free market and exercise its own free will into where it wanted to dock. Betsy was like... Betsy DeVos, who is, I believe, what is she? She's related. She might even be siblings with Eric Prince, the head of the former Blackwater. I don't even know what the latest name of the global mercenary firm is now. And also, I believe, the wife of a guy whose fortune was built on the Amway distributorship.
Oh, yeah, they're brother-sister.
My brother's a mercenary involved in horrific atrocities across the world. And my husband made a stupid amount of cash based off of idiots who thought they could make six-figure salaries selling Tupperware. And I'm destroying education root and branch from making it easier for rape to happen in colleges to taking away school lunches. Quite a life. Oh, no. What happened to the Sequest?
I feel bad for whoever did that to my boat, because that was my brother's favorite boat. You know?
Oh, boy. You'll find my brother's a lot less forgiving than me.
You're going to have Eric booby trap the next one.
I remember when Eric would stick dynamite up cats' rear ends as a child. I was thinking, wow, he's either going to end up in prison or run a global mercenary firm for the most evil aspects of U.S., Chinese, and Qatari foreign policy.
If it turns out this was tanky Lena Dunham, I'm going to have to seriously consider evicting her from my brain.
Would tanky Lena Dunham go to Milwaukee, though?
No, to Ohio.
Oh, Ohio.
Huron, Ohio.
Mm. I'm going to go wherever the rabbit needs me, all right? Like, it's really important and stuff.
I mean, she did go to Iowa for the writer's workshop.
Hey, it's Betsy DeVos. What happened to your boat? So, yeah, that was news that happened. And I like the effect, Matt.
Sounds like someone read that Hamilton Nolan article where he said that folks should start sinking the richest boats.
Hamilton Nolan. I don't think that's explicitly what he said.
He said,
made a atmospheric broad argument which people could interpret and run
stochastic.
With.
He said yeah, their people, yachts were going to get
He was
sunk.
Being sarcastic.
Stochastic.
He was being sarcastic.
Yeah, it would be really irresponsible to tell people to actually do that.
Yeah, totally. Never would celebrate that or joke about it. Or
it's not funny.
It's not Today's show is brought to you by BetterHelp.com. BetterHelp is affordable, private, online counseling. You get unlimited access to a licensed therapist. Fully trained therapist that's perfect for you. On your phone and computer through text, voice, or video chat. They're LGBT friendly. It's great for couples counseling or anything else you're going through in life right now. All you need to do is go to betterhelp.com/majority. You fill out a questionnaire and they match you with a counselor who's perfect for you, and you can start counseling today. And if you decide you don't vibe with the therapist you've been matched with, you can switch whenever you want. It's less expensive than in-person counseling, but you're still getting the same great help from licensed professionals. And if you have trouble affording it, BetterHelp even has financial aid available. You're always connected to your counselor. You'll have unlimited access, which means you can talk to them every day if you want. You connect from anywhere you're at home, work, or on the go, so you're not wasting time traveling to someone's office and sitting around in a waiting room. A lot of people are not comfortable talking to a therapist in person, or they simply don't have time or they can't afford it. BetterHelp solves all of these problems. You could sign up right now and save on a quality professional therapy by going to betterhelp.com/majority. We are going to go to Sam's interview with Randy Weingarten of the American Federation of Teachers, and then we will be back with the rest of the show. Hold on.
All right, so sitting with me is Randy Weingarten. She is the president of the American Federation of Teachers, and you've been so for about 10 years now, is that right?
Yep.
And just
And I am running for re-election this year. I guess I should have said that, but
okay.
Today, but I
fair
am.
Enough. but before we get into sort of some of the issues they're facing, the American Federation of Teachers, and really all public sector unions now in the wake of Janus, the Janus decision at the Supreme Court. Just will you just walk me through just briefly, because there's the AFT, there's the UFT, mm-hmm. there's the NEA. I mean, just delineate for us what the differences are on the teachers' unions, and in fact, I mean, the AFT is not just teachers. So just walk us through that just very briefly, so everybody understands.
Okay, so there are two big unions that are predominantly teachers in the United States of America. The NEA, which I think is a little bit older, started as the professional organization of teachers, like the American Medical Association, the American Nurse Association, and they then, in the 60s and 70s, basically transformed to a union, meaning that they started doing things like representing people in collective bargaining. Okay. The AFT started about 100 years ago. Maybe it's 102 years ago right now. We celebrate our 100th year anniversary in 2016. But we actually started as a union. So Local 1 was the local of teachers in Chicago. And they tried to, they organized in the traditional ways you think about labor. They organized as a union to try to demand conditions of employment and wages for, you know, people there. Local 2 is the UFT. And Local 2 actually started as, in New York City, as all sorts of different groups of teachers. So you had the high school teachers.
Right.
You had the elementary school teachers. You had the female teachers. You had the male teachers. And what happened in Local 2, which is my home local, was between the late 50s to early 60s, they all kind of came together as the United Federation of Teachers. And now we have 3,450 locals. So the biggest one being the UFT, with over 100,000 members, and the smallest one being locals of 2, 3, and 4 people.
Now, I mean, that strikes me as that history strikes me as obviously relevant just in terms of the history, but that dynamic of a bunch of locals coming together
right.
now seems to be somewhat thematically important.
Absolutely.
Relative to this sort of post-Janus period.
Exactly now, right, Sam. And I'm so glad you intuit that, because, you know, we have 5 merged states, meaning 5 states that are basically both AFT and NEA. And I was at the NEA convention, and Lily Eskelson Garcia will be at the AFT convention. And the 4 biggest public sector unions, those in the AFL-CIO, like AFSCME and ourselves, and those who are not, like NEA and SEIU, we have worked together in an unprecedented way. But the big difference between us, our culture in terms of the AFT, I'm not saying this is right or wrong. I mean, we think it's important. The big difference is that we are a federation of locals. So the local is chartered by the national. And we believe that the unit of organization that can create power and agency is a local, not an individual. Because what you can see, whether you organize as craft unions, as the actors have in our country, as the building trades have, or whether you organize wall to wall as the UAW did or as we have, the key to trying to ensure that people have a pathway to a better life is to have power. And we believe that centers not on individuals but on a local working together and organizing together, because they can accomplish what people individually can't. And what just happened this year, with West Virginia, with Oklahoma, with Arizona, is even though those states don't give the same kind of stronger labor laws as a state like my home state of New York, they don't have collective bargaining on the local level, they don't have collective bargaining at all, they mobilized and organized in the truest sense of how unions gain power, working together collectively on issues of common concern, and they became a human shield in those capitals, so that politically those red state governors had to solve the political issue because there were too many teachers on the streets working together in solidarity.
Right. I mean, it was a very sort of, I guess, for lack of a better term, naked use of withholding labor.
Correct.
I mean, that was really
exactly
what it
comes
down to. It was what they were doing was.
But they weren't naked.
Well, indeed.
We just had to be really clear because we are school teachers.
Yes, indeed. Now, this audience, I think, is very familiar with the Janus case. It is it was sort of the Friedrich case part two, but Scalia had passed away and had saved public sector unions. And we now live in in terms of public sector unions, a so-called right to work country, which means that, of course, you always had the right to work. I mean, to the extent that the employers will hire you, subject to the employers. But now agency fees, the payments for the negotiations, and I think probably even more expensively, the issues that come up under the contract, mm-hmm. whether it's.
So this is the difference. I think the word right to work is the biggest misnomer I've seen.
Of course, right.
But what has happened is that a lot of these right-wing groups that, frankly, first, who didn't want integration in schools, didn't want integration in the workplaces, they started doing things that would separate people from each other. And they used the pretext of choice. But you saw it after Brown versus Board of Education. You saw it in what happened in Virginia afterwards, where all of a sudden school districts closed because they said, well, we want to give people the choice of, you know, going to this elementary school, also known as we do not want to integrate this elementary school.
Right.
And we saw that in labor as well around the same time. Right to work was about not allowing an integrated workforce and starting to pit people against one another. Having said that, what has happened in the Janus case was that it overruled basically 45 years of precedent where about 23 states, under the 10th Amendment of the Constitution, had made a decision that it was in the interest of labor peace and efficiency of services. If workers wanted to, they could create unions, and that the public employer would bargain with the unions, just like GM bargains with UAW.
Right.
And
I have 10,000 employees.
Right.
I don't want to negotiate with each one
exactly.
of them. I want to have right.
But the obligation of the union, which gets lost in a lot of this, was that if they had the solemn responsibility to bargain the contract, then they bargained for everybody.
Right.
And the obligation of people was not to join the union. People didn't have to join, but they had to pay a fair share for the work that the union did in representing them in contract negotiations for health benefits, for pensions, for salaries. That's, frankly, what just got busted up.
Right. The ruling from the Abood,
right.
Detroit versus Abood.
And what happened, and the last thing I'll say is what happened was what Abood said 45 years ago Abood took the First Amendment issues, the free expression issues, off the table because Abood said, you, union, if somebody doesn't want to be involved politically, they don't have to be involved politically. What you have the responsibility for doing is the terms and conditions of employment. So the issue of political expression hasn't been an issue for 45 years.
Right. And this is, and we should just say...
That's why this case is so ideological and why Kagan said, Justice Kagan said, it was weaponizing the First Amendment.
Exactly. And we should say, and I want to get more to, you know, how you're responding in this particular environment that we're in those things. But we should say that this is just one element of the weaponizing of the First Amendment. We just saw in a case about fake abortion clinics in California. The First Amendment is being used, literally wielded in every direction that just depending on what the preferred outcome
is. It's being used as a sword.
Exactly.
As opposed to what the original intention was of the framers and the founders as a shield so that people could engage in political speech and not be discriminated against by the government when they engaged in that political speech.
Right. There's this whole theory that is being developed of forced speech, and the implication is that by paying for services that are required by your employer, right, it's really basically... And they're going to do this when it comes to washing your hands in the if you're an employee, washing your hands, it's some type of forced expression.
Look, they may bring a case. I mean, this all started, frankly, if you think about it, Citizens United, Justice Kennedy, basically equated unlimited corporate donations as political speech.
Right.
So that was the first time all of a sudden money became speech.
And so there's a whole
body of work on this.
Yes, no, and again, I point people back to this. I think it was Haley Sweeten Edwards had written about this a couple of years ago about the weaponizing of the First Amendment. But all right, but more to the point in terms of what you're doing here. Give me the reaction. Like what? Obviously, you saw Janice coming, at least since the 2016 election on November 9th. I would imagine that was one of the first things you started to think about.
You mean that elections have consequences?
That elections have consequences, but that Janice, you saw this coming down the pike. People knew there was another one in the pipeline as soon as it got picked up by the Supreme Court.
Well, let me just be clear as a legal matter, because the right wing is now actually using that argument to try to see if they can get retroactive application of Janice. So I want to be, meaning, there's now 17 cases that the right wing has brought after Janice, some of which trying to say, oh no, because Justice Alito has been talking about this for the last 5 years, you saw it coming, therefore you should have 5 years ago.
So you're saying clawback?
Yeah.
Agent, oh my
God. I'm not being funny about this. I want to be
That's insane.
So it's insane, but when you have a Supreme Court that no longer is doctrinal but is just ideological.
Right.
You have
everything's on the table.
Everything's on the table.
Okay.
And so so what we saw is that I actually sat through the Friedrichs oral argument, and I sat through the Janice oral argument. You know, I pretend that I still practice law every now and then.
And there's big stakes.
And I wanted to hear it. And so in February 2015, Lee Saunders, the head of AFSCME, came to our executive council, and we had talked about this beforehand. And from that day forward, we started planning a very different strategy about member engagement. We've always talked about, we've always wanted members to be engaged in the union, and frankly, when they are, the union is much stronger. But the shift was that this was now an imperative. It wasn't precatory, it was mandatory now. And we had to think through how we shifted culture from a culture of members feeling like, okay, they elected their local leader, they elected their state or national leader, and then the leaders did the things.
Right.
And we had to figure out a way that the members not only felt that power, but were engaged and connected and saw themselves and saw the stakes very, saw themselves in the union and saw the stakes very clearly.
I mean, this is broadly a problem that we have with our citizenship in this
right,
country.
Exactly
is,
right.
It changed
because voice. Exactly right. Because voice became, well, it's, you know, it's somebody else.
I
did my job. I elected somebody. You know, and then people stopped voting and on and on. So we had to really change culture to a culture of reimagining engagement and reimagining recommitment. And so that started for us in February 2015. And it started by one-to-one conversations. And so if you look at our resolutions dating back to April, May of 2015, we put ourselves on a course of how we're going to have, and we were going to have, one-to-one conversations with all our members. That started as simply as, how are you? What's going on? Knocking on people's doors, having these meetings in school meetings or site meetings, showing up. And you see from the themes of our convention, caring, fighting, showing up. And so the run-up to Janus was much more about what we were going to do to re-engage our members in the union as not transactional, but a part of their lives.
And I noticed in your speech, in fact, I wrote this down, it was obviously the theme, but you said there, you had at one point a bit of an epiphany that member engagement and community involvement around issues that matter is the pathway for
right.
a better life, but also I imagine the success of unions. So I mean, and then I think
I often say community is the new density.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because I know that we touched on this, and I think the last time we spoke was a couple of years ago, but on this this burgeoning, and maybe it's not that burgeoning, but social justice unionism.
Right.
And in some respects, I mean, is that what, are you saying something similar there?
Yes.
Okay.
But what the difference between what I did today versus the conversations you and I have had beforehand and even any speeches that I've given at the AFT is that the formula, spelling it out, it's not rhetorical anymore. I used examples that people in that audience saw because they have been doing it. And so this was really a reflection, a mirroring back to people of what they've been doing. And frankly, I believe it is the path forward for us because you have right now, and Hillary Clinton actually said this by using Dickens' words, you have a juxtapositioning in this country between basically oligarchic, authoritarian, cronyistic, kleptocratic takeover of most of the organs of national power versus tremendous activism on the ground of people wanting a better life. And it is that kind of David versus Goliath battle where people seem to get it, and it feels like, will the will of the people prevail or will the oligarchy prevail?
Do you think...
it is social justice and economic justice. It is in some ways what King said in the I Have a Dream speech in 1963.
As part of that is engaging in the community, because I want to talk about, like, what does that mean, A, and B, do you think teachers are uniquely situated to do that, or do you think that maybe there's certain advantages that teachers and frankly nurses on some level as well? I mean, they have a similar dynamic in terms of there's a set group of people who there's not as much like a pull there's a pull coming from
right.
the community as opposed to a push that would have to go for the teachers. I mean, being a parent of two kids. And
well, let me just
the son
say,
of, frankly, older parents. I mean...
Right. Let me just say this. I think it's more... You know, I look at things these days through a lens of values and responsibility. And I think because teachers and nurses are really the caring professions, that we are skilled to care and to help nurture, nurses, the body, teachers, the brain. And so we are in a position of great responsibility and can, as a result, if people are willing to do it, help move cruelty to decency. And that's what I think you see. I mean, teachers shouldn't have to do this job, just like teachers shouldn't have to take money out of their pockets right. to buy supplies. But it takes a really special person to want to be a teacher or a nurse. Frankly, I would argue who wants to be a probation officer, who wants to actually be a civil service who's making sure the water is clean in Montana. You know, so we, in some ways, I'm one of the luckiest people on earth because I get to represent the people who really care about other people.
Right. I guess what I'm asking is...
So I think the answer to your question is yes, but it's not opportunistic. That's why I'm answering this way. It is because of who we are as people. And the dilemma is, because our governance structure right now, because in some ways it's been hijacked. I think the Republican Party has been hijacked too. If you look at Steve Schmidt and what he talks about, or even Joe Scarborough, and frankly, I have sparred with them a lot. But on the issue of democracy, if you hear them, I mean, not on the issue of economics, but on the issue of democracy, they're
Steve
pretty
Schmidt, the
upset.
Guy, the guy who gave us...
You don't even have to finish answering.
I'm just saying, like, you know, Sarah Palin didn't come out of nowhere.
Right.
And Joe Scarborough, who also, I would say, you know, I mean,
listen, I'm married to a rabbi. I believe in redemption.
That's all well and good. That's all well and good.
No, I get your point, and you're right.
I'm perfectly willing to allow your husband to go and provide, your wife to go and provide the redemption. That's fine. So
anyway, seriously, I'm sorry.
Well, no, but I want to ask you because, all right, aside from it not being opportunistic.
Yeah, so I
mean, that's fine.
I agree with you.
But I am looking at it from a pure strategy and power. I want to just look at this from a purely a power perspective.
Right.
Okay. So, and I think there is a natural tendency for teachers, obviously, and nurses. Their jobs are to care about people, and so they're going to develop these relationships.
Correct.
But there's also a strategy to this, and there's also going further than just the parents too, right? I mean,
correct.
There's also
in fact,
questions as to where else are we going to exercise this power that we have and to leverage these relationships that we already have with the community.
Correct. And in fact, if you remember, and frankly, there were corporate Democrats who were as guilty as this of this. As, you know, Republicans like Betsy DeVos, Joel Klein was one of them, Michelle Rhee was one of them, that they actually tried to strip teachers of that dignity and that those relationships and that strength by during the last recession, basically trying to say over and over again that, you know, that the biggest issue in teaching was tenure. As opposed to the biggest issue in teaching is how do we recruit and retain great teachers for all our kids? How do we pay them sufficiently enough so that they're not doing three or four or five jobs? How do we have the tools and conditions so we meet kids where they are and help nurture them? And if somebody is not doing their job, you know, due process should not be interpreted right. as a job for life. You know, there should be real evaluation systems. But we had to actually fight through that garbage that was thrown at us in state after state after state as a pretext for austerity and for laying teachers off. And what's happened now in 25 states still spend less money on education. And what you saw in West Virginia, Oklahoma, Kentucky, Colorado, Arizona, was teachers basically saying, look, I love doing this job, but I can't keep on working 2 and 3 and 4 jobs.
Right.
And I gotta actually feed my own family. And this is what was so amazing. And when you try to pit me against my students, I'm not taking the raise and you taking that out of my students' hide. We need to actually have enough money for both, for the kind of conditions for kids. And I think what shocked the country was how much public support teachers in these red states got what they were doing.
I spoke today to one of the Oklahoma City president at the AFT. And he, I think, said that even they were surprised
right.
that nothing after a couple of weeks, there was not the sort of fall off that he had anticipated.
Right.
People were still bringing. And so I guess.
But that activism that we saw in those red states, that's also what you're seeing. Well, that, you know, it is and it isn't. And the reason I say it is in terms of activism. The reason I say it is and it isn't, because there are the issue about collective bargaining is absolutely an essential pathway for working people to have a better life. So what I think you're also seeing in those states that were the blue states that just lost agency fees as a result of Janus, you see also an incredible model of re-engagement and of actually doing more political work in those states. So the irony in both the states that had collective bargaining and the states that didn't have collective bargaining is that you're going to see more political action, that what Alito and Kennedy tried to snuff out actually is going to backfire hugely because people will be more politically engaged. And that is the model. Now, would it be better if a lot of problems actually got solved? There's numerous problems in education or in nursing. At a bargaining table where people could talk them through? Yeah, of course. But what you're seeing now is that they're not going to be talked through, and the employer or the state is not going to respect people. It's not going to be the Koch brothers that employer is going to have to reckon with. It's going to be teachers and parents that are saying, you need to solve these problems because public education is a public good for our kids.
If I was asked you to take a bet, is there going to be more, put aside what just happened? I mean, obviously this will implicate your answer maybe, but is there going to be more withholding of labor in the next 5 years than
yes.
there was in the last 5 years?
Yes, and Alito will end up, look, Alito's dismissiveness and derisiveness of the issue of labor peace is what elitists do. Because they live in their little white towers where they don't actually engage with the people. And what has happened is that when you had collective bargaining, both in the private sector and the public sector, you saw less strikes. You saw less stoppages of work. When you had it in the public sector, what you saw is people ended up solving problems at a bargaining table. And if you don't have that ability to do that anymore, or you have less of that ability to do that, you're going to take it on the streets because these problems have to get solved. The issue about having enough wages to live in a democracy for yourself and your family, the issue of making sure that you're not one illness away from bankruptcy, the issue of making sure that there's public education for special needs kids, making sure you don't have class sizes of 60 or 70 so you can't teach kids. These are legitimate issues. Right. And if we can't solve them at a bargaining table, we're going to try to solve them because this is what people need.
Do you anticipate having more conversations with unions outside? I mean, obviously, you guys are affiliated with the AFL-CIO. I mean, but do you anticipate sitting down and looking across industries that you may not have ever sort of contemplated in the past and saying, you know, we need to have some solidarity that transcends union affiliation, industry affiliation, even genre, right?
Like, yes.
I mean, is that...
And it's...
Are we
going
to see more of that?
Look, first off, Lee Saunders and I both went and spoke at the NEA convention. Mary Kay Henry, Lee, Lily are all coming here. We did a video together. Those are the four largest public sector unions. Larry Cohn and I have talked about how to have some conferences on sectoral bargaining. Now, Larry is no longer the head of the CWA, but we are really thinking through different kinds of ideas. The Democrats in the Senate and in the House of Representatives have two or three really good, intriguing bills that, if they were in the majority, would pass on how you empower labor. Some, you know, ways of growing traditional bargaining paradigms, some new ways. But I do think that this does call for re-envisioning a new way of workers working together, not throwing the baby out with the bathwater, because collective bargaining is a really important way that you create a better pathway for people. It is the root. That and the ballot box are the route to the middle class. But think about, and I mentioned this in my speech, the teachers worked with the steelworkers in Messina, New York, to put pressure on Governor Cuomo, Senator Schumer, the company itself, to keep the Alcoa plant up in the North Country. Mm. That was working together in a way that nobody expected. But we understood that if we don't have that industry in the town, how are people going to be employed? We're doing that with our pension systems, where our pension systems are arrayed together to try to build infrastructure and create jobs. We also are using pensions or talking to trustees about these hedge funds who try to eat up companies, take them over, and then throw the, you know, and then close the plants.
Right.
So there's lots of different ways that we're talking together, some of which is done under the auspices of the ALCIO, which has a futures process going on, but some of it is being done bilaterally between and amongst unions.
When you look back over the past, I mean, the past 10 years, but you've obviously been a union member for years before that. Are there moments where you look back and you say, you know what? Maybe we should have at that time. Like, you look at different junctures.
Yes.
Maybe,
there's a lot of would have, could have, should have. I mean,
what's one of the big ones?
Well, let's look at Wisconsin. I would actually say 2008 to 2010. And, you know, I've had some of these conversations with President Obama when in the tail end of his presidency, like on the issues of education. But I would have pushed that administration much, much harder. For me, it would have been a litmus test that if Joe Biden and President Obama said that they were going to walk those picket lines, they needed to be out there when Scott Walker basically stripped people of rights, because no one was prepared for what happened in 2010. There was we had a terrible recession. The president, the vice president, others, they helped with the stimulus they did get us out of that recession. But the right wing was ready to bear, or was ready for bear. And the moment the 10 election happened, what did they do? They went after labor.
Sure.
They went after public education. They went after voting. We all know the...
Within months.
You know,
I mean, it was 4 months after the 2010 election.
They did it quickly because they knew if it took them a long time, then we would have won those fights,
right,
not lost those fights. And you saw immediately the collapse of the labor movement in Wisconsin. And that was a woulda, coulda, shoulda. And today, we had, frankly, several members from Wisconsin, from Milwaukee, And we took a picture and we looked at each other and I said, we have learned the lessons of what happened in Wisconsin. You are not seeing post-Janus that result. What you're seeing instead is members understanding that's the right wing that's trying to take their rights away. They are really pissed, and they're sticking with the union.
What was the lesson, though, specifically in that context? I mean, yes, Obama had said, I'll put on my soft walking shoes.
The lesson was we weren't prepared. The lesson was that it's the culture change that I just talked about.
I see.
It's the sense of, and I say this often.
You have to be in a constant state of preparing and building power.
Exactly.
Even before you need to use it.
And it's not building power of the leader, building power by her or himself or with a group of, you know, of a few people. It is how do you create a shared sense of ownership in a real way over a shared sense of values so that people own it. People see it. People don't want to lose it. It's like the story I told about my cousin, about her local leader having, you know, showing their contract versus the people piece of paper in Texas. And that is one piece of the story. But to me, the more important piece of that story for me was to hear her then proudly talk about her involvement in the union,
right,
and that she was now taking ownership, that it was her power, and it was not, what is the union going to do for you? It's, wait a second, we could lose this if we're not engaged. That's the transformation, and frankly, that's we did that in the Capitol in Wisconsin. I was in the Capitol. I was in Madison. It was amazing. It was amazing to see the farmers supporting us, but we did that with activists. Now, what's happened is that we have engaged the vast majority of our members, who see whether they're going to be active or not, that the union is important to them. That's the difference, and that's what's happened in the aftermath of Janus. That's why when we heard people today, the recommitments that, you know, because in January of this year, so we started down this path of one-to-one conversations and engagement, but in January of this year, we talked to lots of different folks, and we started on the path of recommitments, recarding. And that's, we already have 530,000 people of the 800,000 people
that's
affected by Janus who have recarded. And that's why now the Freedom Foundation has said in Washington State, oh, no. None of the cards that were done before June 27th are legal. Now, that's bullshit. It's a frivolous lawsuit with a judge who understands the Constitution and wants to apply it, you would get attorney's fees for that kind of frivolity. But that's what I mean by the 17 cases against us.
All right. And let me just ask you, I mean, so we have a vision of what the unionism is going to look like. The irony is, too, is that I know that if we had this conversation a couple of years ago, we would have been talking about the so-called education reform movement. And you mentioned there were Democrats, you know, and Arne Duncan, I don't know what your perspective is.
I found it pretty funny that he was starting to call for for student walkouts because of gun issues.
Right.
I mean, look, I understand the frustration, and I think it's right. We have to do something in the aftermath of Parkland.
Right.
But I found it a little ironic.
Yes. Arne Duncan was not exactly a bottom-up type of...
Right. But I supported it, but I found it ironic.
Bill Gates Foundation, just very quietly, the other day, Rand Corporation came out with a report. They got virtually no news. Basically said, like, that's $700 million? Whoops. The whole teacher evaluation thing, yeah, we got that wrong. It basically said it's about inputs. If you want to education, it's about inputs. Kids can't show up to school with a vocabulary deficit. They can't show up with a nutrition deficit. You got to deal with healthcare. You got to deal with the community. And that $700 million, of course, was also exponentially, a lot of people spent money in that direction because that's where a bulk of the money went. And so there was this whole movement. That seems to have sort of like completely fallen apart there's a new battle here, but do you feel like things on at least a philosophical perspective on education have actually improved?
Yes.
While the material...
So frankly, and I know a lot of people don't give her enough credit for this, Hillary Clinton, in running in 16, helped hugely to put these battles to bed, as did Barack Obama in the willingness to negotiate and agree to the new ed reform law, ESSA, because a lot of the overreach of No Child Left Behind and of
Race to the Top
got muted in the new law through the prohibitions on the secretary. And so you had Democrats like myself who said, oh, no. We need to prohibit the secretary from mandating testing as part of teacher evaluation, because that was part and parcel of what created the testing fixation.
Right.
We have to mandate that the Secretary of Education can no longer demand that schools be closed. We have to mandate that the Secretary of Education can no longer require a set of standards or curriculum. And you know, if you had asked me 10 years ago as a Democrat, 20 years ago as a Democrat, would I ever have been fighting for that? I'd be looking at you like, wait a second. I thought, you know, war on poverty, Secretary of Education, it's about expanding equity. But because of their overreach, including Democratic overreach, because Democrats, that's why I did this in the speech today as well, Democrats as well as Republicans, corporate Democrats as well as Republicans, thought they could reduce students to test scores and teachers to algorithms.
Right.
And we fought that back. And if you looked at the Democratic platform that the Bernie folk and the Hillary folk all negotiated together when it came to education, it wasn't perfect, but it actually was a template for how to resolve these issues. And then on top of that, you had a Betsy DeVos who basically gave up the pretense that charters or vouchers was about equity. It was really just about privatizing a school system and
right.
having people fend for themselves.
Right. When she talks about public education, she's talking about a pool of money that she can channel to
correct.
Exactly.
To so then what you have is these corporate Democrats who say, well, am I with public education or am I with her?
Right.
And so she has in some ways forced their hand. And so, you know, there are still charter folks like, look, the L.A. school board and the fact that Ref Rodriguez is still on that school board is terrible. But there are still battles like that. But when you have the NAACP saying, look, we want a moratorium on charters until the equity issues start working for all the students, and then you have what you just have seen throughout the country, which is people believe in public education, they think teachers need to be more respected and have the latitude to do their job, have to be paid more, so we actually get teachers who are not just basically living paycheck by paycheck and being crushed by their student debt. So,
all right, lastly,
anyway.
let me ask you this, because you raised the 2016 election. There was some controversy about the timing of
yes.
of the endorsement. If you had to do that over again, would you do the process different? Would you, with the timing, with the process, are there any reforms relative to that? Or what?
Well, I mean, the answer is, of course, yes and no. I thought I would actually push very hard for the 16 election to have done what we did in terms of moving early. Because you either in the 16 election, you either chase the race or you frame the race. And on the issue of public education, we needed to make it quite clear that the issues that we were pushing for needed to be forefront, not the corporate folk like the Michelle Rees and the Joel Kleins, who had basically tried to hijack the Democratic Party away from teachers, parents, and those who actually believed in music and art in schools rather than testing. What I would have done differently, and what I didn't actually understand at that time, was how the climate and the distrust and the frustration had so poisoned every institution. And Tim Schneider has said this a lot in his book, 20 Steps for Tyranny. But at the end of the day, the moment somebody says everything is rigged, it doesn't, because we had more interaction, more engagement before that endorsement in the primaries than we'd ever had before. Not just polling, not just town halls, not just talking to people, but people who disagreed with the decision didn't believe that any of that had happened. So that the issue in retrospect was, how do you create trust in a situation where people don't trust? And that's what the issue was. In terms of going forward, I think you have to wait and see. There's a lot of people that are coming out. You got to see what's going on. But frankly, more importantly than anything else, I'm fixated on the 2018 election. Right. Because we have to win enough in 2018 to move cruelty to decency and to defend our democracy.
Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
I love it. Stop relitigating 2016, unless you're like actually figuring out lessons to learn that are relevant. 2018 is paramount. Good interview. That's a good example of people who are maybe in a different place than I am, as an example. It's politically, how they move, though, and how they learn and adjust, because they do have actual convictions.
Well, it shows the side of a cultural change, right?
Like
they endorsed Hillary, and now she's using words like corporate Democrats and things like that. Like, you can tell the language is sort of the early signifier.
Definitely, no doubt. Become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. That's how this whole thing happens. Over 90% of it is because of you. Check out justcoffee.coop, fair trade tea, coffee, or chocolate. Get the Majority Report blend. Give the Majority Report a review on iTunes. Subscribe to the Majority Report YouTube channel, which is just serious growth.
Long, sustained growth.
We haven't seen growth like this before.
Ever since late November. Something happened.
I would recommend that certain YouTube channels look into it really carefully. I love to feed dumb people's paranoia.
Mike Sermon, Sermon.com.
Been growing about 750 to 1,000 subscribers a day since late November. Late November.
Something happened then.
Who's laughing now, Sam?
I think that was Sam's pound for pound best moment, when he got to be like, oh, I'm laughing now.
Do you remember when we played Bad Boys for Life, like the day after MSNBC rehired Sam?
Yes.
I don't know if there's a greater moment of triumph in my life.
I'm not trying to bring this back up again, but when Dore did his whole thing on, he had his whole meltdown on me, presumably because I was on the TYT panel, and it was like, all right, I'm going to need to take care of this on TMBS. And then it literally ended with a like, and until then, shut the fuck up. And then it was like, bam, for life. Bad Boys for Life really can. It gets you in that mode. They had a magic. On TMBS on Tuesday, we did a deep dive with Marissa Bararadaran, who wrote The Color of Money, and we talked about the history of banking, capital formations of this country, and then, of course, the Sam Harris intellectual dark web, repackaging old right-wing ideas for a newer audience that have been discredited for decades, and the sociology of why they do that. New bits, Nelson Mandela, own Zionists with facts and logic. We have the Griscom Economic Minute, which is a new segment we do now. There was also Iran content and a lot of other things. And if you become a patron, you get Woke Bros, which I co-host with Big Waz, Wazni Lambre, joint production with Count the Dings. And then also, of course, Illicit Histories and Idea Primer series. As an example, this Sunday, Zach Carter and I, an illicit history of trade from Ricardo to Trump. So patreon.com/TMBS. Check out the new TMBS YouTube channel. We've been up for 48 hours and we just went past our first 1,000 subscribers. That's a great way of sharing, shorter content to spread the word on the Michael Brooks Show. And we're also on iTunes as well. Thanks, everybody. What's up on Antifada, Jamie?
Well, we have a new episode dropping today, whenever Sean wakes up and posts it. Wherein indeed, wherein we talk to our friend Wilson Sherwin of the CUNY Grad Center about the National Welfare Rights Organization, which came out of a radical movement in the 60s and 70s composed mostly of women of color who came around to some fairly radical anti-work politics via collective struggle.
And that's connected with Frances Fox Piven, right?
Yes.
Fox Piven is a boss.
She really is.
Very important person.
She played a foundational role in it, and she is also, not coincidentally, the thesis advisor of Wilson, who's currently working on her thesis on that topic. So we talk about that. We talk about Marxist feminism and all the silly stuff that I mentioned yesterday, like nutcrackers and dating as a Marxist feminist.
Hey, baby, put down that pipe and get my pipe up.
Exactly.
Literary Hangover, Young Goodman Brown came out this weekend. We've just passed 500 subs. 500.
Sweet.
Moving on up.
Steadily.
You can watch it on Twitter. No, you can't watch it on Twitter. You can watch it on YouTube and all the places, or most of the places that, any of the places that people have bothered me that you want to listen to it on podcasts, I put it there also. So,
very winning strategy. I've delivered it in all the places where you've harassed me about wanting to see it.
I'm responsive to that.
Yes. And also Patreon.
Patreon.com/literary hangover. We're at 75.
Sweet. Brendan's Patreon project is, I'm sure, going to be happening at some point. I mean, it's inevitable.
I'm gonna see what's up with the Majority Report before I branch out into the wiles of Patreon.
Brendan's food reviews.
He's biding his time.
Brendan. This is... Well, I think Brendan should do reviews of Dead concert bootlegs.
No one's going to pay for that. The music's free.
No, but that means you could use it.
But not your commentary. You could use the free music and then explain, like, the year was 1979.
I would be going
at the disco era was at the tights, and people thought the Dead were irrelevant.
It's like me with the
small group of community members were still gathering.
I would be stepping on this guy, Grateful Dean's territory.
Oh, I've never heard of that.
You guys ever go on, like, YouTube, like, holes and just, like, find things?
Not for Grateful
Dead. No, never.
Well, it was a rhetorical question. But anyway, there's this guy, Grateful Dean, that I found who just, like, has reviewed every, like, show and the ones that are going on now, and he's like hilarious. It's like listening to someone do, like, a sports review.
That's what I was thinking for you. What if you did every episode was another variation on why the Dead are awesome and Fish suck with Brendan? That would be fun. I would definitely listen to that.
The narcissism of small differences with Brendan.
Yeah, then you get
exactly. He knows that what you just said is totally wrong.
The problem
is, you can break
that
down over hundreds of episodes.
But there's already a Fish podcast too. There's Analyze Fish.
Oh yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, and his response podcast could be Jerry's Dead, Fish Sucks, Get a Job.
It's a more crowded market in the jam band podcast.
Well, I had no idea. All right, we're gonna go to the fun half, and we're gonna do the same great new transition song we have from. Remind me the name.
Bullprog.
All right, thank you, Bullprog.
Tart on SoundCloud.
Okay, see you in the fun half.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabs.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. Are you guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.